business risk and failure. Instead of managing business risk to minimize or avoid failure, the focus here is on maximizing success. The Valley recognizes that failure is an unavoidable part of the search for success. Silicon Valley does not punish business failure. It punishes stupidity, laziness, and dishonesty. Failure is inevitable if you are trying to invent the future. The Valley forgives business failures that arise from natural causes and acts of God. Changes, for example, in the market, competition, or technology. The key question here is why a business failed. When you have a big idea, as Go had, and you turn out to be years ahead of the market, failure doesn't end careers. Ironically, businesses that fail for acceptable reasons can actually provide a wealth of experience and increased opportunities, as was the case for all the key players at Go. Ted Williams once said, "Baseball was the only human endeavor at which one could fail 70% of the time and still be a success." To baseball, I would add the venture capital business, in which only 2 or 3 in 10 of all funded business ideas eventually hit big, the internet phenomenon notwithstanding. For the investor, the explanation of this paradox is simple. The lonely winners return 10 to 100 times or more what the losers lose. With those odds, you can see how the VC business and the Valley work. And if you understand that, you can understand how VCs evaluate business ideas. They want something that will make a difference, and not a small difference. Hedging is not the way to get their attention. Reducing your downside risk will not warm the cockles of their hearts. Business failures are unfortunate, but necessary steps in the search for those few huge successes. I reached the top of Page Mill Road and turned north on Skyline, along the ridge of hills that mark the volatile San Andreas Fault. These hills, the result of the millennia-long collision of tectonic plates, literally define Silicon Valley to the east and shield it from the Pacific Ocean on the west. This ridge is part of a plate drifting inexorably toward Alaska. For some of us, Silicon Valley's forgiving attitude toward failure rests on a more profound realization. Change is certain. In a world of constant change, we actually control very little. When there are important factors outside your control, the risk of failure always looms, no matter how smart or industrious you are. We delude ourselves if we believe that much of our life and its key events fall under our control. Most people will respond to that statement by saying, "Of course, obviously." Yet many still believe that those who enjoy exceptional achievements and accomplishments rode to the top entirely by themselves. The media always looks for a single person, a CEO or an entrepreneur, to personify the accomplishments of an entire company or industry. It makes good reading, but it's simplistic. Someone in the Valley suddenly finds himself worth $100 million and begins to believe he earned it and therefore deserves that money because of his skill and ability. The rest of the world, egged on by the media, tends to be seduced by the myth, despite the hard work of many others in the role of simple, dumb luck. How many of these people accept equal responsibility for the failures in their lives? When you experience the vagaries of success and failure firsthand, it is as hard to accept credit for success as it is to accept blame for failure. For a long time, I certainly took full credit for my success. I became a lawyer, an expert in the rules that governed the game, worked at Apple in its heyday, and then helped build a highly successful startup at Claris. All that convinced me that I could determine my own fate. It was at Go that I finally realized there were forces at work far larger than anything I or anyone else could control. Riding the highs and lows long enough, never being able to see beyond the next peak or the next valley, makes one realize there is only one element in life under our control, our own excellence. Here's what I tell the founders in the companies I work with about business risk and success, and what Lenny needs to understand. If you're brilliant, 15 to 20% of the risk is removed. If you work 24 hours a day, another 15 to 20% of the risk is removed. The remaining 60 to 70% of business risk will be completely out of your control. My father's a gambler, I tell them, a blackjack player. The game is always in the house's favor. If you play blackjack consistently, you can only lose. Unless you are, like my father, a card counter. He plays the ebbs and flows of the opportunity based on some probability he continuously calculates in his head as he watches the cards dealt. By playing each hand to the best of his ability, he is ready to take advantage of the odds the instant they swing in his favor, wagering more when luck smiles on him and building his winnings in those moments. Of course, the casinos have made it harder by increasing the number of decks in the shoe and reducing the number of hands played before reshuffling. Nevertheless, my father plugs away, his love of the game unvanquished, waiting impatiently for his chance to win. If you're excellent at what you do, and the stars are in alignment, you will win. Of course, you may run out of time first, but if you are excellent every day, you will have furthered your chances of beating the house as much as they can ever be. That should be your primary measure of success. Excellence, not simply the spoils that come with good fortune. You don't want to entrust your satisfaction and sense of fulfillment to circumstances outside your control. Instead, base them on the quality of what you do and who you are, not the success of your business, per se. Unless you understand what is truly outside your control, you are likely to make serious mistakes, misallocate resources, and waste time. I encourage people to think about all the risks involved, personal risks as well as business risks. When I talk to candidates as part of recruiting outside management talent to the Valley, the issue of risk often comes up. Prospective managers usually fear that the venture won't be a blockbuster, or worse, that it will be forced to close its doors. Some recruits fixate on that business risk to the point of indecision. They strain to research all the facts, but at some point, no additional information or assurances will offer them any further clues into the business's ultimate success or failure. Uncertain, they freeze and stay with the status quo, no matter how unsatisfying it is. After all, it's what they know. But when I drill down, I inevitably find personal risks that need to be considered along with business risks. Personal risks include the risk of working with people you don't respect, the risk of working for a company whose values are inconsistent with your own, the risk of compromising what's important, the risk of doing something you don't care about, and the risk of doing something that fails to express or even contradicts who you are. And then there is the most dangerous risk of all, the risk of spending your life not doing what you want on the bet, you can buy yourself the freedom to do it later. Several years ago, when I pondered the offer to join Apple and I looked down that long corridor at my law firm, the answer was clear. I was not concerned with whether Apple's business would succeed or fail, or whether my options would be valuable or not. What I had to weigh was whether I should remain on the well-defined path to professional and financial success as a lawyer, or venture into a creative life in business, with no specific destination in mind. I was not hesitating because of business risk. I was wrestling with personal risk, a different game of chance in which we have far more control. When I considered the risk of staying at my law firm, I had to face the possibility of an unfulfilled life, of working endlessly on things that did not matter, and that at times violated my core values. I had to face subordinating my creativity in order to become a specialist, channeling myself too narrowly. To me, these were graver risks than whether Apple succeeded or failed. Ultimately, I chose to pursue what seemed most important to my life at that time. In theory, the risk of business failure can be reduced to a number, the probability of failure multiplied by the cost of failure. Sure, this turns out to be a subjective analysis, but in the process, your own attitudes towards financial risk and reward are revealed. By contrast, personal risk usually defies quantification. It's a matter of values and priorities, an expression of who you are. Playing it safe may simply mean you do not weigh heavily the compromises inherent in the status quo. The financial rewards of the moment may fully compensate you for the loss of time and fulfillment. Or maybe you just don't think about it. On the other hand, if time and satisfaction are precious, truly priceless, you will find that the cost of business failure, so long as it does not put in peril the well-being of you or your family, pales in comparison with the personal risks of not trying to live the life you want today. Considering personal risk forces us to define personal success. We may well discover that the business failure we avoid and the business success we strive for do not lead us to personal success at all. Most of us have inherited notions of success from someone else or have arrived at these notions by facing a seemingly endless line of hurdles extending from grade school through college and into our careers. We constantly judge ourselves against criteria that others have set and rank ourselves against others in their game. Personal goals, on the other hand, leave us on our own, without this habit of useless measurement and comparison. Only the whole life plan leads to personal success. It has the greatest chance of providing satisfaction and contentment that one can take to the grave tomorrow. In the deferred life plan, there will always be another prize to covet, another distraction, a new hunger to sate. You will forever come up short. Work hard, work passionately, but apply your most precious asset, time, to what is most meaningful to you. What are you willing to do for the rest of your life? Does not mean literally, what will you do for the rest of your life? That question would be absurd, given the inevitability of change. No, what the question really asks is, if your life were to end suddenly and unexpectedly tomorrow, would you be able to say you've been doing what you truly care about today? What would you be willing to do for the rest of your life? What would it take to do it right now? On this hilltop, I look left toward the Pacific Ocean, across the sloping fields where artichokes and poppies grow, where cattle and horses graze. This is rustic rancher country. And to the right, all the frantic splendor of the valley, a teeming maze of highways, bumper-to-bumper traffic, and business parks. Speculators, the Lennies of the world, still keep coming to this small patch of land, this boomtown settlement, and pay astronomical real estate prices for a chance to work their stake. Like the 49ers 150 years ago, most will leave empty-handed. But some, a few, will amass fortunes and become the leaders of the new. This is a valley of optimists. Me, I like being on this ridge, one foot in both camps, one hole from two very different but equally compelling pieces. In school, I belonged to no particular clique, hanging out with a group of people, both brilliant and crazy. These peripheral people were highly talented with offbeat passions, like performing autopsies on busted televisions and computers, building telescopes, practicing ventriloquism, or painting watercolors of dissected animals. Wrapped in their passions, they stood outside the mainstream. I loved their talent and innovation, and I acted like a bridge, connecting them to everything else. Now I work with inventors, entrepreneurs, and others highly skilled in their own right, but not necessarily capable of bringing their ideas to the commercial light of day or achieving the impact their ideas could and should have. This is the creative edge of business. Startups working with a blank canvas to challenge the status quo and make change happen. I work with brilliant entrepreneurs who have a vision for how things can be better and who can't resist doing the next great thing. I am their consigliere. The last time I was in Amsterdam, I spent an afternoon in a Rijksmuseum, studying the Vermeers and Rembrandts. Rembrandt's The Night Watch particularly impressed me. Like many of the Dutch masters, he painted it on commission for a group of well-heeled patrons. The work portrayed a dozen or so elaborately attired commissioners, reliving the past glory of their civic militia, arrayed according to their financial contributions and status. These were some of the many movers and shakers of Holland's economic golden age, affluent and prominent, seeking immortality on canvas. But I was struck that I didn't know any of them, nor did it matter. They were just characters in another man's masterpiece, the only person of importance, the only one whose fame had lasted beyond that period, was the eventually penniless artist Rembrandt. Think about the Night Watch today, when so many people push and shove with their wealth, fame, and power. In 100 years, all of today's movers and shakers may be reduced, at best, to another group of supporting characters on a canvas. That painting brings to mind a headline from a few years ago. Sam Walton had died, the richest man in America, making him, I realized, only the latest in an eternally long line of such record holders. As John Maynard Keynes postulated, in the long run, we're all dead. Time is the only resource that matters. Email to 8Whitlock. From Randy. Subject, regarding one last question. I think it's up to you, Allison. If you want to pursue the idea that you and Lenny first discussed, you'll need to take the reins and pull Lenny forward. You have nothing to lose. Try to answer as many of the questions as you can. but don't worry that you won't have all the answers. Plan how you will discover them. Good luck. Best, R. Chapter 10. The Whole Life Plan. "We're going to put the fun back into funerals," Lenny said. Was this my cue? "The fun back into funerals?" I asked. "Cut it out, Lenny," Allison chided. "I hate that." Lenny laughed. "I wanted to see your reaction," he admitted. He handed me a copy of his new business plan. "Besides," he said, "it's more the case now than it ever was." No denying it, Lenny's sense of humor left a little to be desired, but I was glad to see he was his spunky self again. "Maybe I should say we were going to put the fun back into funerals.com," he said. "Except it's not funerals.com anymore." Lenny pulled out his extendable pocket pointer, poked at the cover of the plan, and read the title to me, "Presentation to Randy Commissar. Some habits are impossible to break. Business plan for circleoflife.com," he continued. "I can read, Lenny, remember?" I looked at the cover page. "Circle of Life? What's that mean?" "Let's go through the pitch," Allison suggested. "It should all become clear." "Fine," I said. My curiosity piqued. It had been 10 days since I heard from either of them, and I'd assumed the clock had run out. I felt sorry that Allison hadn't prevailed and frustrated with Lenny's steadfast denial, but I was also confident the internet wouldn't lack for casket floggers too long. Then, out of the blue, an email. "To Randy, from Lenny. Subject, still breathing. Randy, we are not dead yet. After a lot of soul-searching, in light of all that's happened, we've revised the business plan and convinced Frank to give us one more hearing. He'll see us in 2 days, early afternoon. We'd like to run our ideas by you first. Can we buy your morning chai at the Conditori? Thanks, Lenny." So here we are again, deja vu. As usual, the Conditori had quieted down by mid-morning, except for a young couple with a baby and a designer carrier and an occasional takeout customer. We had the sunny place to ourselves. A bootleg tape of the Dead's Friend of the Devil played in the background. Connie was kibitzing with the staff, taking a breather. She had welcomed Lenny like an old friend, forgetting for now the putrefying bacteria. She had a natural way with people, and she knew more about business than most of the young bucks who come around here looking for me. I really should discuss a partnership with her. Lenny's fun remark had caught my attention because it was at least the third echo of my first encounter with him some 3 weeks earlier. In his corporate uniform again this morning, he had greeted me at the door without the arm lock and guided me to the table where he and Allison had set up shop. There, the similarities thankfully ended. Lenny was just as intense, but his energy was leavened with warmth and a sense of humor. Allison, too, seemed to have settled into her own skin, no longer ambivalent or hesitant. She and Lenny were in sync now. After I sent her my reply, Allison explained she had spent the weekend strategizing with Lenny. He had been ready to throw in the towel, but she had persuaded him to try another approach. "So circleoflife.com came out of that weekend?" I asked. They both nodded. "What we first described to you in funerals.com," Lenny said, "is still here, but it's only one part of a much bigger idea." "Does your family all live around here, Randy?" Allison asked. "No," I replied. "Upstate New York, New England, and my wife's family is from Pennsylvania, Florida, North Carolina, everywhere but here." "It's the same with Allison and me," Lenny said. "My family is strong in Boston, but two brothers live in the Midwest, and my sister lives in Florida. My father had 7 brothers and sisters spread all over the East and South, and one out here. Allison's family is scattered around New England and the Southwest. In this day and age, families and friends have to work hard to stay in touch. No one writes letters anymore, Allison added. When my father died, Lenny explained, I paid a neighborhood kid who knows HTML to make the site you saw. I wanted a place where the family could gather, post messages, and remember. Not only did it shrink the distance between us, but it made it easier to share feelings. You saw some of the postings. A couple of my aunts and uncles told stories about growing up with Dad, and some of my relatives posted old photographs that we'd never seen before. Pictures of Dad as a kid and of the entire family through the years. It was a comfort to us all to remember Dad and commemorate his life. It was a good thing, Lenny went on. Many of my friends who have visited the site said they'd like to set up a place for their families too. Anyway, Allison chimed in, when Lenny and I looked at everything fresh, we returned to a simple premise. The business should make it possible for people to come together and cope with death and dying. That's our mission. And we'll sell caskets, Lenny interjected. And we'll sell caskets, Allison concurred. Absolutely. That's an expensive decision people have to make at a difficult time. The more information you have, the better the choice. Wherever we can find reputable funeral homes who provide good service and take reasonable margins, Lenny said, we'll work through them. There still needs to be someone local to make the final arrangements. We can steer people to the best facilities and protect them from gouging. Not just caskets and liners, but other services too, Allison quickly added. Counseling, burial sites, gravestones, options for final disposal. I raised my hand. Whoa, I said, let's start with a plan. I generally prefer to get off the pat presentation and into the passion, but too much was tumbling out at once for me to absorb. Lenny and Allison's original idea, the one buried beneath funerals.com, was to create internet communities in which family and friends could honor and remember someone who had died. In returning to that idea, Lenny and Allison had expanded it to include people in the process of dying, the terminally ill, and those who care for them. We'll make it easy for communities to form around someone's dying and death, Lenny said. We'll bring together family members and friends wherever they are in the world and give them an opportunity to grieve, remember, mourn, and show their support in ways not possible until the web. At the same time, we'll help the dying cope with their own deaths and give them the resources to make plans, financial arrangements, and estate planning, for instance, for the families they leave behind. We need to deal with death and dying much better as a society. This business can help. We want to make one's last moments as meaningful as possible, Allison continued, by providing people with the opportunity to connect to those who have given their lives meaning and purpose, and, in the end, to make sense of their lives in an intimate and caring community. It was about closing the circle of life, I thought. This lets us tap into the huge market we talked about before, Allison pointed out, but in ways much more caring and comprehensive. The basic service, Lenny went on, would be free. It would include templates and guidelines, he explained, making it easy for anyone to create a community site with photographs and writings. The framework for this basic service would be built with the help of experts in grief counseling and terminal illness, as well as doctors. Those who set up or joined a community could simply visit the site, sign in, and choose from what's available there. Then, if they wished, they could participate more actively by communicating with other members. A simple site would be free, and there would be a charge only if the site exceeded a certain reasonable size or if the activity exceeded a specified time limit, say 6 months. Clever, I thought. This way, people would be encouraged to use a service for free and pay only when they found it valuable to maintain in the long run. Easy adoption, an internet version of trying before buying. Of course, the site would ultimately have to provide real value to convince people to homestead it, but even casual traffic could bring in revenues from advertisers and sponsors. Our plan, Allison said, is to provide targeted information about care, drugs, therapies, and support services for everyone involved in that final stage of life. Community members wouldn't be bothered by advertising. They would see information on specific services only after they had registered their interest in them. As a result, Lenny and Allison wouldn't merely be selling eyeballs. They would be providing qualified leads to their commerce partners. Users could request information and receive answers and referrals to all kinds of resources, some local and some on the internet. CircleOfLife.com would charge a fee to merchants in exchange for qualified leads, those people who indicated their interest in finding help. Nonprofits would have free access. It would be a better arrangement for everyone than simply selling gross demographics to advertisers. Qualified leads were far more valuable to merchants than bulk traffic, and the process would be more consistent with the experience Allison and Lenny wanted to create for community members, less crass and commercial. They also planned to host various events and forums for which individuals might pay a small participation fee and which could feature special guest experts or the opportunity to exchange information with members from other related online communities that share similar problems or needs. The ability to link separate communities so members could help each other would be a particularly useful feature. For example, they explained, family caregivers, the ones supporting a dying person, often face special burdens, suffering alone in their grief as they continue to care for their loved ones. CircleOfLife.com would give them a place to communicate with others in similar situations. They can turn to each other for support and especially to express the feelings, their anger, for instance, they can't express to family and friends, Allison said. Their plan was still to sell the funerary goods they identified in the original business. Where there were reputable local sources for those goods, CircleOfLife.com would refer members to those sources. And where those vendors were commercial businesses, such as funeral homes, CircleOfLife.com would receive a percentage of the sale, like an affiliate. With this approach, Lenny explained, revenue would come from a larger number of sources. One of the weaknesses in the original funerals.com, I pointed out, was the issue of finding or being found by those in need. You still have to generate traffic to make this work. Yes, of course, Lenny said, but this approach is more inclusive and less in conflict with the local brick-and-mortar businesses. He went on to explain that they planned to form alliances with reputable local funeral homes for which they could be both a source of business through referrals and a web presence to supplement the funeral home's physical locations. They also planned to form partnerships with those whose daily work brought them in contact with death and dying, including, for example, social workers in hospitals, hospice personnel, and visiting nurses, as well as related membership organizations. They planned to seek endorsements and referrals from national religious organizations of all denominations, which would inform their member churches of the benefits CircleOfLife.com offered. In short, their plan was to form a vast web of those whose aims were congruent with their own, to ease the passage of those terminally ill and the grief of the survivors. If they could establish CircleOfLife.com as the preeminent place to build communities addressing those needs, particularly for far-flung families and friends, that network would provide a competitive advantage. The more people who gravitated to the site, the more valuable it would become to others as they shared information and attracted more local providers of goods and services. Competitors could try to duplicate this model. But once CircleOfLife.com established itself at the center of the network, competitors would find it difficult to dislodge. This scenario is referred to as the much-coveted network effect, an increasing return on the benefits of growing scale on the Internet with little or no marginal cost. What Lenny and Allison proposed to do required an enormous amount of work, and success was far from guaranteed. But here, the risk was in the right place, in the execution of the big idea. Their idea embraced fundamental life needs and would employ the proven strengths of the net, making it hard to believe someone somewhere couldn't make it work. If it were to succeed, they would have to execute quickly and with great discipline. They would need to build a vast network of relationships as well. No small challenge. "Have you made any progress on hiring a team?" I asked. "We've only had a week or so," Lenny said, "but with our raising some seed money..." "We forgot to tell Randy," Allison said. Once they had formulated the new idea for CircleOfLife.com and put together the rudiments of a new business plan, they'd gone back to a small group of angels Lenny had approached months ago. The angels had turned Funerals.com down, but a few were now intrigued enough with the new plan that they had invested $500,000 in seed money. With that, Lenny and Allison had quit their day jobs to work full-time on the business. "I thought very hard before turning down the HMO job," Allison admitted. "There was a lot I liked about it, the opportunity to build a community of people struggling with serious illness. But once Lenny and I agreed on the basic premise underlying CircleOfLife.com, I didn't hesitate. This is what I want to accomplish, and if I didn't at least try to do this, well, here's my chance. The Internet seems to offer the potential now to do something important in a way never possible before." I looked through the plan. They had made assumption after assumption about the services offered, sources of revenue, their ability to enter alliances with traditional brick-and-mortar businesses and organizations to form the crucial referral networks, the potential fees, and charges. Lenny must have been uncomfortable with those leaps of faith, but the plan also laid out a timetable that identified both the crucial steps and what they hoped and expected to learn at each stage. They were candid and detailed about what they didn't and couldn't know at this point, and they identified how they would refine and reshape the plan as they continued to educate themselves about the market. The plan was a reliable compass, as it should be, not a roadmap. They had indeed already made progress in putting together a team, identifying a strong candidate with a technical background and some startup experience to bring the site up, and beginning conversations with a small group of counselors and doctors who are amenable to serving on an advisory board. Someone with accounting experience had expressed interest in joining them part-time in the beginning, expanding to full-time if the thing took off. The team wasn't locked up, but they had apparently found some good candidates who would join as soon as more financing was secured. They had created simple pro forma financial statements based on the segments of the existing market they expected to migrate to their service and form the core communities in their network. Then, for each community, they had identified the various potential sources of revenue and the estimated total revenue. It added up to a number that would probably be large enough to get Frank's attention. "What do you think?" Lenny asked. Less tidy and tightly wrapped than the Funerals.com presentation, this plan was a bit raw. All in all, though, not a bad job for 10 days' work. Most important, the plan communicated a stronger vision, an idea with a wider horizon focused on meeting a critical need. For all its loose ends, it had real potential. I told them to be completely candid with Frank, engage him in the power of the idea behind CircleOfLife.com, and enlist him, to the extent he was amenable, in helping them find the answers that would make it a success. "What if it fails?" I asked. It was a more defensible idea with stronger commercial underpinnings, but it was still a crapshoot. "We talked about failure," Lenny said, "and I agree with what Allison said before. I'd always be sorry if I didn't try this. We're realistic about the chances, but we believe we can make this work and grow," he shrugged. "If we do our best and it fails, we'll still be glad we did it. It's worth doing." "And if it's a great success," Allison added, "this is just the beginning. We'd like to build communities around the entire spectrum of significant life events, like births and graduations and weddings and all the events people want to share with friends and family." "That's the circle of life in the name," Lenny said. "When we thought about what weaves together all those events, we realized it was the family. People will still be able to build sites for individual events, like a birth or a wedding or a death, but we also want to provide the opportunity for life events to be organized around families. That's the context in which most of these events are celebrated anyway. And once you make it easy for family members spread around the world to link up," Allison continued, "you open up a whole new realm. Imagine this. Families could connect to form broad, deep genealogies. In a few years, our children will be able to go on the web and surf their way back through generations or jump across a family tree, from the tip of one branch to the tip of another. Rich with pictures and words. Imagine the sense of community that makes possible, even in a world where extended families rarely stay together. The web of life. The forces of technology pull us apart, and yet that same technology provides the means of staying together." Lenny smiled. "Most of the advantages of living in a small town with all your relatives," he said, "without living in a small town with all your relatives." "None of this," he added, "requires new technology. All the pieces exist. What will make CircleOfLife.com different and attractive is the valuable information we'll provide, the common ground for communication, the simplicity and accessibility of the site, and ultimately, the communities that will form there." Lenny looked at his watch and realized they needed to leave for their meeting with Frank. As they packed their cases, Lenny said, "You must have lots of questions." "It's a rich idea," I said. "I'll look at the plan in more detail and email you my thoughts." "Do you think it will work?" he wondered. "I don't know," I said honestly. "I think somewhere, somehow, something like it will work. As you said, the technology for creating online communities exists today. Somebody just has to figure out how to put it together with the right content and information in a compelling way that people will value and someone will pay for." Allison stood and shook my hand with a satisfied grin. "Nervous about your meeting?" I asked them. "Sure," Lenny said. "This is important to us. Frank is doing us a big favor. We can't blow it." "Good," I thought. "Welcome to the whole life plan." "Do you think Frank will like it?" Allison asked. "I'm not sure," I said. "I worry they were seeing Frank a little too early. They had so many ideas that still needed winnowing, refinement, and integration. Focus and organization would be key, as it is in all startups. They would need help strategizing and prioritizing. The good news was they had a wealth of enthusiasm and vision to work with now. "We're going to make this happen one way or another," Lenny said. Then he lowered his tone a notch. "Allison and I have talked about it, and we'd really like to have you join us in some fashion. Give it some thought, will you? I smiled, flattered, as always, when somebody invites me along for the ride. I walked with them to their rental. They got in, and Lenny rolled down the window. I leaned over so I could see them both. Let me know, I said, what Frank says. If he's not interested, I might know somebody who is. Epilogue. The Road. When all is said and done, the journey is the reward. There is nothing else. Reaching the end is, well, the end. If the egg must fall 3 feet without a crack, simply extend the trip to 4. Nearly 25 years ago, stranded on a deserted road in Scotland, this certainty struck me. It was a damp and dreary day. Cold April rain spit from the steel-gray sky. The wind whipped down the hills and ripped through my winter coat. The landscape was forbidding. Craggy, rock-strewn, good for a few sheep, but not much else. A friend and I had been on the road for a week or so, hitching from London. A ride with a long-haul trucker had gotten us to Glasgow, but as we headed east to Aberdeen and then north to Inverness and Loch Ness, friendly drivers, or any cars at all, were harder to come by. Near Aberdeen, we finally landed a ride from a bonny lass, a bit of a talker. She had just broken up with her boyfriend, she admitted, and she seemed intent to practice her flirting. We obliged her and practiced, too. She wasn't going far, so she invited us back to her farm for a bite to eat and a drink. It was clear she meant alcohol, and with my rotten luck, a vegetarian looking for something green to eat in the British Isles, a steaming bowl of haggis. A friendly girl, a little food, and a lot of drink, a warm, dry cottage on a cold, wet afternoon. How could I say no? But my plan simply would not permit it. This place was nowhere, certainly nowhere on my itinerary, and I needed to set my eyes on Loch Ness and hightail it back to London so I could cross the channel to Paris. I had planned this trip for months, studying the maps and circling the names and places I had to see. I was intent on packing all of Europe's monuments and museums into 4 or 5 months, a low-budget 70s version of the Grand Tour. I had spent years deferring to the exploits of my preppy friends who had already made their tours. I was determined to catch up. So I dragged my buddy out of the car. On the roadside, the invitation disappearing in the rearview mirror as she drove off, we surveyed our situation. Two figures alone on a two-lane road running north-south. I could see in both directions for miles, and there was nothing. No cars, no people, no houses. Only some lonely, dirty sheep keeping low to stay earthbound in the bluster. For the first hour or so, we maintained our spirits by joking about our predicament, convinced it would end soon. The few cars that passed paid us no mind, and depression gradually seeped in as we realized there would be no surprises. We could see for miles in both directions, and nobody was coming for us. As the sky darkened, we left the road and began foraging in the pasture for rocks, optimistically turning back from time to time to scout for our ticket out. A narrow ravine divided the pasture in two, and we started to build stone ducks along the edge for something to do, to prove we were here. I started tossing stones into the ravine, trying to gauge its depth. Sometimes I could hear the rocks hit the water deep below. Sometimes they would bounce off the ravine's steep sides. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000. I counted the seconds and tried to calculate the ravine's depth using my best high school physics, but my measurements varied wildly with each throw. I gave up. Deflated, I sat down in this pasture, head in my hands, trying to figure out how I could reshuffle my painstakingly prepared itinerary to get back on my schedule and salvage this trip. At this rate, it wasn't going to happen. And then, in the middle of my anxious what-ifing, I began to feel a subtle change, the warm touch of the sun on my shoulder. It had succeeded in breaking through the shroud that had enveloped us all day, leaving bright streaks and a burgeoning rainbow. Behind the curtain of mist, I finally saw the beauty that had been right before my eyes the entire time. A mad torrent rushing through the sheer ravine, the snaking ribbon of tarmac ahead and behind, and the emerald green hillsides dotted with sheep, contentedly munching and chewing. And me, sitting in a quiet pasture, on a lonely road, in a lost patch of Scotland, in Europe, on an adventure. As the sun burned away the dampness, I realized this was it. With 4 to 5 months away from the habits and routines that I had chained myself to at home, this was precious time. What was the sense of rushing down a beaten path with a map I had cribbed from others? This was my trip, my life, and I needed my own journey. I decided to throw away the itinerary and see where this might lead. More than an hour later, an older couple picked us up and drove us the rest of the way to Loch Ness. We settled in, hung out at the pubs and cafes, took in some of the sights, and savored our time. Eventually, we returned to London. At a party in Soho, I met some people who set me up with their friends in Paris. A week eating bread and cheese, drinking wine from the bottle, and trading off between the Jardins and the museums. I was ecstatic. Next, I met some people grabbing a train to Spain and tagged along. I kept going. Madrid, Lisbon, Morocco, Barcelona, Milan, Venice, Bologna, Florence, Rome, Athens, Santorini, Crete, and everywhere in between. An ever-expanding realm of new characters and experiences greeted me at each stop. A local gadabout in a bar tipped me off to a secluded beach full of naked travelers in Corfu. I found it. The border between Greece and Turkey was shut tight over some hot-headedness, but a Swiss girl showed me another route on a fishing boat from Rhodes. At a crossroads again, Marmaris, Turkey. My Swiss guide was heading for Afghanistan and points east, and she welcomed the company. It was July, getting late, and according to my schedule, I should have been heading to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to start another leg of my life. I thought back to the road in Scotland. The choice was all mine. Where was this life headed? Regrets either way, I forged ahead. To Istanbul. Rumor had it I could get to Amsterdam from there, and that Freddie Laker would honor my ticket to New York. I'd never been to Amsterdam. Why not extend my journey another foot? No time to waste. Acknowledgements. A highly collaborative creation, this book leaves me heavily indebted to a remarkable group of people. Hollis Heimbach, my trusty editor and guide, who saw a book where none existed and rolled up her sleeves to make it happen. I am forever hers. Kent Lineback, my partner in crime, who had the unenviable task of trying to form my incoherent ramblings into a story. He worked tirelessly and deserves the credit for much that is right about the book, but he can't be held responsible for its shortcomings. My lovely, precious wife, Deborah, who continues to stick by me through thick and thin, even though I give her countless reasons to give up on me. Bill Campbell, my mentor and longtime friend, who refuses to take the blame for anything I may have learned along the way. Bob Roden, lawyer extraordinaire, who shepherded me through the Byzantine business of publishing. Patty Cullen and her merry crew, whose cheery conditori makes the best non-fat chai latte in the valley. Constance Hale, cooler than thou, who translated my gibberish into English and got us out of a tight spot. Genevieve Yosa, who was always there with kind and generous support. Dan Kellogg, who put the fun into funerals. The many entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and other business associates who have given me much more than I can ever return. My dear family, especially my mother, who mercifully avoided any mention in this book, and the innumerable friends, teachers, and fellow travelers I have had the good fortune to meet along the way, all of whom have given me plenty to think about. And of course, my constant sidekicks, the horrible hounds, Tika and Tali, who lounge listlessly at my feet as I toil, rolling on their backs from time to time to demand a rub when they think I may be missing the point. I thank you one and all from the bottom of my heart. This is Randy Commissar. This production of The Monk and the Riddle, The Art of Creating a Life While Making a Living, presented by Harper Audio, was directed by Lewis Milgram and engineered by Tim Neff, Rob Hoffman, and Ryan Roberts. It was produced by Milgram Productions. Executive producer Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2000-2001 by Randy Commissar. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.